So, back in 2003, when the Art Institute was moving forward to the construction of our new modern wing, we started to really think about the impact of the whole project on the museum. And one of the things we, of course, thought about was the impact of vibrations on the collection. So, you know, one of the first things you do is start thinking about how, you know, how the vibrations affect different kinds of objects. And you have here some of the factors that that would be involved: the size, the shape, the method of the construction, materials. All of these factors impact on how an object responds to vibrations, both in terms of its behavior and the risk to the object. And then you also have to consider the kinds of vibrations that you're dealing with. And you can just very broadly divide things into two kinds. One is the sort of the short impact vibration, and we experienced a couple of those during our construction project, the sort of thing that happens when, during the demolition, a chunk of wall falls down unexpectedly, and boom, there's a big shock that works its way through the ground and into the building and into the object. So that's one category, a general category. And then you also have more sustained vibrations, the kinds of things that that are happening when you're doing pile driving, and that's where you know, things get kind of interesting, because different sorts of things start to happen. But you know, if you're just looking at the objects, let's say you're dealing with a pastel. Well, that's pretty obvious. You know, a loosely bound pigment on a piece of paper. You know, that's going to be sensitive. You know, and then you might, at the other end of the spectrum, you might have a solidly built steel sculpture, let's say, that is not going to be at all vulnerable to the vibrations. But you have objects that then fall across this entire spectrum. And then you also have to consider condition of an object. So something is not only weakly constructed, but maybe has suffered some kind of deterioration along the way, it's going to be even more vulnerable. If you have, let's say, a 2,000-year-old sculpture that has a repair that was done 200 years ago, and you can't really know exactly how that was done or the strength of the repair, then those objects would fall into the high-risk category, and you're going to want to contain the level of vibrations. So, you know, what you have when you approach things in this way is that you have you have all of these factors, and you have a lot of complexity, and you know that the objects are going to behave in a wide range of ways. So it becomes really so complicated that you need a way to sort of cut through this, all of this uncertainty and ambiguity, a way of looking at things that will really allow you to, you know, come to certain clear decisions. And one of them is, what is a safe level of vibrations, you know, or maybe more precisely, what is that threshold between the, you know, point at which vibrations are, you know, ambient and not harmless to most works of art, to that point where they really become kind of risky. And since objects we know are going to behave in very different ways, how do you find one level of vibration that sort of applies to an entire collection? So that's, you know, one of the questions. And of course, that's one of the things that you really have to know, because your contractor will want to know what that limit is going to be, and they also need to know because they have to plan their work around that, you know, and select techniques and equipment and and plan the whole process to, so as to avoid exceeding those limits. And then from the museum side, you want some level of certainty because you need to know which works are going to be deinstalled. You need to know which, how much temporary storage space you need for the collections that are being taken off view, and you need clear answers to these things. So, what we did was we turned to Wiss Janey, and they really helped us cut through some of this uncertainty, and to develop a whole protocol that involved measuring, assessing the building, because we really needed to know the behavior of the building. We, especially as it concerned these sustained vibrations that can cause harmonic responses in certain objects. You know, think of an object as a guitar string that vibrates at a certain frequency. Well, every object has that kind, those kinds of properties, as you'll see here discussed by Arne and see demonstrated. And so. And if you have a sustained vibration, and an object has a harmonic response to those vibration, it becomes even more, more of a concern because the effect of the vibration is going to be amplified. So, as I say, we turn to Arne and Bob. And they really helped us develop a protocol that would ensure safety of the collection on the one hand, and also provided a safe limit and a way of monitoring during the whole construction process, and also a set of protocols and vibration limits that allowed the contractors to plan ahead of time and to work efficiently. And of course, the other great objective was to, in doing all of this planning, was to avoid an interruption of the construction. We didn't want to have problems after we started that would cause everything to shut down and maybe require us to move whole galleries of the collection. So by doing this kind of advanced planning and working with the protocols that Arne and Bob helped us develop, I think we ended up with a pretty much an event-free construction process. And you'll see in some of the images that Arne shows you that we really had a very intensive demolition and construction process, and this is the final result of our construction over here.
Frank's dealing the clicker.
Sorry.
All right.
You must have the clicker, the remote. So I am the nerdy engineer, and my colleague Bob Hannon is also a nerdy engineer. So this will move quickly. I guess you can call yourself a nerdy engineer, but you probably shouldn't call others. Well, anyway, for the next 20, 25 minutes or so, this will be a little bit like a class. I hope you can track with me. I'll move quickly. And I would like to talk about how we can move from ambiguity to some level of certainty and solving this problem of vibrations at museums, which we did first for the Art Institute in Chicago and several other times since then. The information that we're going to share is mainly contained in these two technical references, which you can pick up online if you need to. One that we co-authored with Frank for the Journal of the American Institute of Conservation in 2013, and one that we just put out this year, Bob and I, on vibration limits for historic buildings and art collections. And by the way, that is a picture of the St. Louis Art Museum. I see Jeanette Faust in the audience. Many of you know Jeanette, I'm sure. We collaborated with her on that project. So it's a small world. Well, I first became involved with vibration control at museums when the Modern Wing Edition at the Art Institute of Chicago was in early conceptual design in about the year 2000, so roughly 15 years ago. In this aerial view, the new Modern Wing is to the left, and the original Art Institute buildings are to your right, the oldest of which date from 1893. Well, construction of the new wing required demolition of several buildings on its site, including the old Goodman Theater, the Art Institute's old mechanical plant, and a large cooling tower, which you see there in the foreground. The challenge was that right on the other side of the demolition line were active galleries with some of the museum's most significant artwork. Demolition of those buildings required very heavy work that generated very significant ground vibrations, as did the deep excavation, earth retention, and foundation work that followed. As the demolition progressed to the south, it got very close, within about 50 feet, of some of the most significant artwork in the museum. Here you see nighttime demolition of that cooling tower. This is a little eerie, isn't it? Nighttime demolition of that cooling tower that was located right next to active galleries. So obviously immense planning and vibration controls were required. Well, this is the architect Renzo's piano model of the Art Institute's campus. The gray shaded zones are the new construction work, and I've superimposed the heavy dotted lines that show the multiple interfaces of the new construction with the existing buildings. The pictures I've been showing so far are from that central zone, but there were three other vibration critical zones as well. So in all of these zones, we performed vibration testing and trials, and then monitored vibrations using over 20 seismographs, monitoring continuously for more than 3 years. I'm not as interesting as the other room, but you can applaud if you'd like at any moment. Oh, come on now. I'm a nerdy engineer, just a nerdy engineer, very nerdy. I have my pocket protector right here. Well, through all of our work at museums, we've come to learn what you already know, which is that the goals of vibration control in the context of a museum are very, very unique. First and foremost is protection of the collection, as Merv has already said. This is a non-negotiable. But also, we found that it's very helpful for the museum to receive guidance before construction starts to facilitate advanced planning of all kinds, such as what vibration levels to expect and where might you need to deinstall certain objects. Then the final goal is reliable enforcement of clear, conservative vibration limits, but without unduly encumbering the designers, which might hamper their design process, or the contractors, which could slow the schedule or increase cost. So let's walk through how we might achieve these various goals for a museum. And first, you need to know some basic terminology. I said this would be a class. Well, at the most fundamental levels, vibrations originate at a source, transmit through a media, normally soil. This pointer doesn't work very well. And then reach a receiver, which in our case is a building of various types, right? Well, depending on the source type, the vibrations can be more transient or short-term in nature, or more continuous or steady state, such as Frank said, by pile driving. The magnitude or intensity of the vibration is measured in what we call peak particle velocity. Again, terminology. This is measured in units of inches per second, and that's essentially the strength or intensity of the vibration. And then the change of that intensity with time is what we call vibration frequency, measured in hertz, cycles per second. So in all of the charts that I'm going to show, and yes, I do have some charts, on the vertical axis will be peak particle velocity. So think of that as like the magnitude or strength or intensity of the vibration. And then on the horizontal axis will be frequency. So this is the rate or speed of the vibration. All right? So first, let's talk about human perception of vibrations. The first thing you need to know is that the human body can perceive extremely low levels of vibration. I would venture to say that if you were to come up and stand next to me here and pay careful attention, and if I were to jump, you would feel the floor vibrate, almost certainly. Roughly speaking, human perception begins, depending on frequency, at around 0.03 inches per second. And these will all be in the same units, so if you just remember the number, you can track with me. So 0.03 is human perception. And then vibrations become disturbing to the human body. Essentially, our organs begin to resonate, which is not usually very comfortable, when vibrations reach an intensity around 0.2 inches per second. Next, ambient or background levels of vibrations due to just normal day-to-day activities in most buildings can be up to 0.1 inches per second. You can see some common values there for things like closing doors, crowds, walking, running, jumping. Just notice the last two bullets in the list there. We recorded vibrations at the Art Institute due to passing commuter trains up to 0.07 inches per second. And moving tables and chairs after an event actually generated vibrations up to 0.15. So we need to remember that ambient vibrations in buildings can be very significant, well above the human perception threshold, which, remember, is down around 0.03. So what does this mean? This means that in most buildings, if you pay attention, you will feel background vibrations. Usually not alarming to you because you're accustomed to it, but we need to remember that. Now let's consider the effect of vibrations on buildings, and in particular, what levels of vibrations can damage buildings. The U.S. Bureau of Mines carried out extensive studies in the 1970s and 80s to evaluate the effect of blasting on nearby residential structures, and one of our founders, Jack Wiss, was instrumental in that early work. Based on their testing, the Bureau of Mines then reported damage levels, actual damage levels for buildings. Threshold damage, which they defined as hairline cracking of plaster finishes and similar very minor cosmetic damage, typically appeared at about 3 inches per second and was never observed at less than 0.5 inches per second. Minor and major damage to structural elements required much higher values, as you can see there, upwards of 4 to 8 inches per second. The Bureau of Mines then published a recommended safe limit to prevent threshold damage in buildings, and this remains one of the most common limits cited in the United States to protect buildings from vibrations. You can see that the limit has a base value of 0.5 inches per second and then increases at higher frequencies because we know that higher frequency vibrations are typically less damaging to buildings. I just want to point out that there are similar international standards. I've shown here the British, Swiss, and German standards, and you can see they're similar to the U.S. Bureau of Mines limit. So there's relatively good agreement on what vibration levels to protect buildings. But now for the complicated subject of art and vibrations. I say complicated because, as you can imagine by looking at all these different art objects that we've actually encountered in our different work at various museums, each object will respond differently to vibrations, right? Because each has a different size and shape and mass distribution. To further complicate matters, each object is also in a different condition. Some are very sound, but others are very fragile and weak. So at the outset, we have to acknowledge that the response and vulnerability to art, to vibrations, is very variable and complicated. However, it occurred to us as we got more deeply involved in museum projects that, of course, art objects experience some level of vibration when they are shipped between museums. So we, as structural engineers, undertook to read the conservation journals on vibrations that art experiences during transit, and Merv and Frank were very helpful to us in this process. And what we learned was this. Of course, before shipment, special vetting, crating, and bracing of objects is performed, but during shipment, very large shocks on objects are common, from things like crate handling, abrupt stops and starts, and so on. And during truck transit, sustained vibrations directly on objects of 1.5 to 3 inches per second are common. And if you think about it, most shipment of art includes truck transit at least some point along the journey. Yet despite these very significant levels of vibration, adverse effects rarely occur during the transit of art. Well, next, we reviewed the literature to find information on art located near construction sites. And what we found was this. vibration limits from 0.1 all the way up to 1.5 inches per second have been successfully used to protect art during several recent museum construction projects. However, there's very little information on levels of vibration that have actually caused damage to art, as this is obviously something that we all want to avoid. There is one case of damage reported, and that was at the British Museum in 2000, when unfortunately damage did occur to 12 art objects at vibration levels in the range of 0.6 to 1.8 inches per second. And all of this damage was reported to have occurred in areas of pre-existing weakness on those objects. So I've given you a ton of information. Let's superimpose and try to simplify all this on one slide. Human perception, remember, begins at around 0.03 inches per second, and ambient levels in buildings are often up to 0.1. Structural damage does not occur until well over 2 inches per second, and threshold cracking in plaster never observed below 0.5. Art in shipment commonly experiences 1.5 to 3 without adverse effect. And damage to art occurred at the British Museum at levels from 0.6 to 1.8, all in areas of pre-existing weakness on those objects. Well, if you step back from this data, I think, like us, you will come to the conclusion that vibration limits in this in-between zone ought to be adequate to protect artwork that is in reasonably sound condition. And so we, in fact, have judged that a limit of 0.1 inches per second should be conservative to protect most art objects. I see some of you trying to take pictures. If you want to pick up our papers online, seriously, all this information is there. You can enjoy my very entertaining presentation. No. But feel free to take pictures. I just wanted to point that out as well. This limit has been used successfully at several museum construction projects here at the U.S. Well, there are some important exceptions and caveats, of course, regarding this limit, and we'll be demonstrating those with our simulator in just a couple minutes. Walking of light objects can occur on smooth surfaces at lower levels. Resonance of objects that happen to have a natural frequency similar to the construction vibrations, especially continuous construction vibrations, can be problematic. And then, of course, extremely fragile objects or those with serious pre-existing weaknesses might be vulnerable at lower levels. And all we can say is that measures should be taken on a case-by-case basis to protect against these unique risks where they exist. Well, I hope that background gives you some good feel for the different levels of vibration and how they might affect objects in a museum. For the rest of our time, I'd like to give you a quick rundown of the process, the methodology that we've used successfully now at various museums during their construction. And whenever I explain this method, I like to use the analogy of a three-legged stool. Of course, you all know that a three-legged stool relies on having all three legs for the stool to remain stable. And in the same way, successful vibration control at a museum, as we recommend it, has three essential phases, and they all need to be present to support those goals that I laid out earlier. Well, the phases are laid out according to the timeline of the project. Before construction, there should be pre-construction testing on site, planning with the museum, and then development of a project-specific vibration control specification for that project. And then at the start of the construction, contractor submittals and vibration trials, which I'll give some examples of. And then during construction, what most people think about for vibrations, that is the monitoring, which should occur throughout construction with appropriate alarms and notification protocols. So let's walk through each of those steps one at a time, and I want to take an example. I could use St. Louis, Jeanette, but I switched this to the Art Institute for today. This is the central zone of the Art Institute, right next to the modern wing. I've already shown you quite a few images from that work. So first, what should happen before construction? Well, the very first step before the modern wing work was for the museum to select the vibration limits that they felt were appropriate for their specific construction project and their specific collection closest to the work. And the Art Institute, after study and consultation with us and others, adopted the limits shown here. So the building limit was the U.S. Bureau of Mines limit to prevent threshold cracking in plaster walls, beginning at 0.5 and increasing at higher levels. And the artwork limit was indeed the 0.1 inches per second, following the same general shape but shifted downward. So this limit should be safe to protect artworks that are in reasonably sound condition. Some items were deinstalled, as I'll highlight in a few moments. But next, we needed to predict in advance what levels of vibration might occur in the museum during the planned work. And we did this by site testing. This is a plan view of the lower level on the left and the first level of the Art Institute in that central zone. So basically, this image on the right overlays on top of the image to the left. So the pre-construction testing that we performed involved installing vibration sensors, which are all those little blue dots, throughout the galleries. And then we made low-level impacts at the locations of the red X's while simultaneously measuring the response in the galleries. On the left, you see an example of a modal hammer low-level impact, a very calibrated computer-actuated hammer. It looks like a sledgehammer, but it's actually very expensive, at the building demolition line. And then on the right, you see the array of seismic, or rather accelerometers, that we have distributed throughout the nearby galleries. Well, analyzing all of this data allows us to calculate the actual vibration characteristics of the building in this particular zone. And then, if we scale that data up to represent the energy of actual construction equipment, we can predict vibrations that will occur in the building due to various activities. We normally report those results in the form of what we call contour lines. This is just one example. These are the contour lines for a large hydraulic breaker operating along the demolition line. You can see the lines along which different levels of vibration will occur if that activity is done at the demolition line. Those values, of course, decrease with increasing distance away from the source. Now remember that the vibration limit that was adopted by the Art Institute to protect the art was, remember, 0.1 inches per second, which I've highlighted there in red. So if this were the only piece of equipment to be used on this project, then it would be safe, to locate art behind that red line. Do you get it? So one can go through this exercise for every type of construction equipment planned for the project and generate one comprehensive line beyond which it should be safe for artwork to remain, and we've come to call that line the safe line. Behind the safe line is the protected zone where artwork should be safe to remain, but in front of the safe line is what we've called an unprotected zone where art objects that are sensitive to vibrations should be deinstalled, and in fact were deinstalled at the Art Institute before construction began. Well, this simple but scientific method has proven to be a very practical way for museums to plan their operations and deinstallation decisions in advance of the construction project. The final step before construction commences is for the vibration expert to develop a vibration control specification for that particular project, which needs to be included in the contract, in the bidding and contract documents, so that it's contractually binding on the contractor. The specs should define the vibration limits and the safe lines, and then require the contractor to devise their work so as not to exceed those limits at those lines. It should provide some minimum requirements and guidance so that they can plan and price the work without guesswork or over-conservatism. It should require field trials and define the requirements for the monitoring system and alarm capabilities, and then lay out the protocols that have to be followed if an above-limit alarm occurs. Well, all that happens before the start of construction. There are variations for each individual museum. Some may be very short in terms of this work. Others may be quite involved, like at the Art Institute. But the second leg of the process occurs right at the start of construction. And this should be contractors' submittals, means and method submittals for their work, and then vibration trials. Field trials should be required for every vibration-causing activity that the contractor proposes to use, especially nearby art. The trials use actual equipment, actual operators, but working at a safe distance from the artwork. If vibrations are measured to be within the limit, then work with that piece of equipment can proceed, right? But if not, the contractor needs to change his methods and repeat the trial. It's as simple as that. Many trials were performed at the start of the modern wing. Construction work on the left is a large hydraulic breaker, demolishing some concrete there along the seawall next to the old train tracks. On the right, that very specialized nighttime demolition that required very careful trials in advance to make sure that vibration transmission into the galleries would be acceptable. Caisson drilling on the left within 5 feet of the building wall, which was trialed before it was performed. And on the right, vibratory sheet pile driving that was tested at the start of the project to verify that it would not produce above limit response in the galleries. Once the trials have been successfully completed, then construction can proceed. And the final phase is the vibration monitoring that should occur throughout the construction. Monitoring in the context of a museum, in our opinion, serves as the final proof that potentially damaging vibrations have not been caused. It's not the only proof, or should not be the only proof. It is the final proof for the museum. Vibration monitors should be positioned both along the safe line to protect the artwork and along the building demolition line to protect the building, especially if it's a historic building that requires a special care. Notice that the limits along these lines are different, right? Each monitor is then outfitted with a cell modem or internet connection, and all of the monitors are interconnected to a central data acquisition system that receives and analyzes the data in real time, as Merv has pointed out. Here are some views of some typical monitor installations. We'll show some pictures here in a minute when we get to our demonstration. The seismographs, cell modems, and wiring all fit very nicely within enclosures that can blend very neatly with the surrounding galleries. I'm very proud of this one, proud on behalf of the Art Institute. Look how they even built the trim of the gallery right around the enclosure. But again, very inconspicuous and very well done. Of course, for a museum project, it's absolutely crucial that the monitoring system be capable of triggering alarms and sending immediate notifications of any above-limit vibrations that are recorded. The vibration notifications should go to the museum and the vibration expert, but perhaps most importantly, to the contractor's foreman right on the site, who must order that construction stop immediately. The cause of the alarm must be reviewed, the building inspected if necessary, and the contractor's methods changed as appropriate before construction can resume. I know you can't read this one, but these are just some examples of some data reports that we've issued for various projects, this one for the modern wing construction. Regular data reports are very useful to the museum to confirm that vibration levels have not exceeded any limits, and also for the contractors, so they can see what their work has actually caused in different areas and when. For example, this is just vibrations through the course of a week. Notice right here, something happened right there, right? So the contractor can go to that day and figure out what happened and where and troubleshoot his work. So that was a really rapid summary of the process that we've used. There's much more detail in our full paper. We'd be happy to speak with you afterwards to give you further detail. Suffice it to say that this method has proven very successful in several recent museum construction projects. It's worked well for the museum staff. It's also been well received by the contractors in every case, and so we commend it to any of you who might be undertaking construction at your museum. I was asked by the conference program committee to comment briefly on vibrations that might occur during normal building operations, not necessarily during construction. From sources such as heavy traffic outside. This is, again, the Art Institute with commuter trains going right through it. Perhaps there's also construction on neighboring sites that you can't control, okay? I see some heads nodding. Maybe even internal mechanical equipment causing some vibrations. Well, if you suspect that levels at a particular location might be problematic, we would recommend the following. First, measure ambient levels in that area of concern. You might be surprised. For example, at the Art Institute, remember, passing train traffic measured 0.07, but ambient levels were actually up to that as well. So measure the ambient levels to give yourself a baseline. But then number two, of course, monitor during the activity and compare the two. If you're less than ambient, I think you're done, right? But if you're more than ambient, then compare the measured levels for to those safe limits that I've laid out. And if you are indeed over those limits, number one, I would advocate with who's ever causing the vibration, perhaps insist or at least request that they reduce their vibration activities. If possible, number two, move sensitive artwork away, at least temporarily, from those vibration high zones. And then thirdly, for non-movable objects, one can design vibration isolation mounts or supports. There's a very good reference coming out in the Journal of the American Institute for Conservation by Andrew Smith on the subject of vibration mitigation at the object level, sorbitane pads, etc. So that can be done. And if you have any further questions about vibrations during normal building activities, feel free to come up and we'd enjoy talking with you afterwards. So now for some fun with our vibration demonstration. To help us get a more practical feel for all these numbers and things, we constructed this vibration simulator in our laboratories. And Bob, you have a microphone, right? My colleague Bob Hannon is going to assist me on this. So Bob, why don't you explain how this simulator works?
Dynamic shaker on the base below. There's a threaded rod extending up connecting to the aluminum plate. The actuator is controlled by a laptop that is running a program that we wrote in LabVIEW. With this, we can generate steady sinusoidal motion or pulses at controlled frequencies and amplitudes. The magnitude is measured with an accelerometer. That's a small, Arnie is actually showing an example of that, a small sensor that is being measured by the program so we can control the amplitude and frequency of the vibrations.
I'm just showing a couple images of more typical vibration monitoring equipment.
Okay. Yeah.
On the left is a seismograph like was inside of those enclosures. And then Bob's got the laptop-based system here using accelerometers.
Okay. Now, we typically monitor the vibrations in the museums with the seismographs on the left, the Instantel Minimate Plus is shown there. And that's connected with the cellular modem, which provides the remote access to our server. And we also, in the case of the St. Louis Art Museum, we used a laptop-based system with that small accelerometer that Jeanette Faust was able to locate wherever they had any particular issue. And we developed a program on that duplicated what the seismograph records. Then we wanted to demonstrate this to you, what we're looking for is two volunteers from the audience to come up and see whether or not they can actually feel vibrations in this plate to get an idea of the difference between perceptible vibrations and what we established as a safe limit for art. So I'm looking for two volunteers to come up. And, okay, we got two right here.
All right.
Actually, yeah.
They can take turns.
Three might be a crowd, but that's okay.
So while Bob is giving them some instructions about how not to get electrically shocked and such, I'm going to demonstrate on the screen here two of those special cases. So direct your attention to the screen. We'll come back to them in just a moment. The potential for resonance, I want to just explain that a little bit more. On the left is an image of a Chinese jade collection at the Art Institute. Essentially, these pieces of jade are connected with little pins back to a wood board. And on the right is our device to simulate that. We're not going to rig it up today, but we've got a video of it here. So we've got different sizes of metal discs that are connected to a wood board with metal pins. Right? And what we're going to do in this video clip is to apply a constant steady state vibration while we sweep the vibration frequencies from zero up to a certain value. And what you're going to see is resonance, hopefully the video plays, of these different objects as we reach their natural frequency. So at 9 hertz, we get resonance of the big disc, and then little response as we continue to increase the frequency. But at 12 hertz, massive resonance of the middle disc, little response at around 20 hertz. And then at 33, the little guy starts to dance. So the lesson here is to guard against the potential for resonance where it exists, and that jade collection at the Art Institute was in fact deinstalled before construction. Just one more quick example, as they are enjoying the simulator. The danger of walking.
A little massage on
your
hands. I know.
We're not even. All right. Okay. The danger of walking. And when I said walking, the AV, Ian said, "You mean people walking?" No, I mean objects walking. We've observed walking of objects on glass shelves at various museums during our work. Even low-level continuous vibrations can cause objects to walk. So let's look at an example of that. On the lower left, I'm going to input a steady-state, low-level vibration at 32 hertz. And if you look closely, right at there, the little glass cordial will walk to the right. Do you see it right there, walking? It's moving almost magically. And then on the lower right, the glass goblet, in this case, as we apply a constant low-level vibration, walks to the left. Okay, so the lesson here is objects that have the potential of walking on very smooth shelves should be restrained, right, before continuous vibrations. All right, so are we ready, Bob?
I guess we're ready.
Okay.
What we're trying to demonstrate here is the fact that I'm inputting 0.03 inches per second vibration on this plate, and what I hear back from my observers here is that I feel little tingling sensation. It's not just being up here with me. So, but you do feel a tiny amount of vibration. But that's this level that I'm putting in there now is 0.03 inches per second. That's what's considered the perception threshold for vibrations. If this magnitude of vibrations was occurring in the floor and you're sitting in a chair in a quiet room, you might be more likely to feel it. But apparently you don't feel it.
So if someone recommends a vibration limit down around this range, you now know that that's not really reasonable, right?
Right. Because if you felt that this magnitude of vibration, if you put your hand on the art object and you felt that magnitude of vibration, would you be concerned about it? Oh, okay. It depends what it is. So we have differing opinions, which is clouds. That's the problem with vibration consulting. It's very personal. Okay, so I'm going to increase the amplitude up to what we consider the safe limit. I took it a little bit beyond. Take it back down. There. It's about 0.12 inches per second that I'm putting in right now. And that's what we typically set for. It's a limit that's established for historic buildings, the buildings that are under historic preservation order. And in many cases, we use 0.12. Often we use 0.1. Depends on the particular museum of interest. But
tell us what you feel. How would you describe it?
It's like a heart pulse, like a heartbeat a little bit.
Yes.
Yeah.
So okay.
You feel it.
Yeah.
You feel it.
Right.
Would you describe it as strong or weak, or how would you describe it?
No, not strong.
Not strong. Okay. But perceptible.
Okay. It's perceptible.
Okay. So bear in mind the artwork protection limit that we've recommended is quite low. I mean, barely perceptible, but still noticeable. Okay, let's crank it up to 0.5. Now, this is, remember, the building protection limit that's traditionally been used in the industry apart from artwork or historic buildings. And how would you describe when Bob gets there at around 0.5?
Not there yet.
Okay.
Getting up there. 0.45. We're at 0.46. 0.45.
Yeah. That's good. So how would you describe now that level?
It's because you're holding it down too much.
How would you describe that?
Concerning.
Yeah. Concerning, that's a good word. So much more perceptible. So again, this is above the human annoyance or disturbance value around 0.2. So let's give a big round of applause to our volunteers. So after this immediately after this session, if any of you would like to come up and experience the vibration simulator, it's actually a very valuable experience. If you ever need to judge for yourself what level of vibration you are feeling in a building, and to know whether that might be concerning or not, this is a very valuable experience. With that, Bob and I have shared everything that we have. I think I'll turn it back over to Merv, and we can take some Q&A.